Online harassment has become a fact of life for many people in the age of the internet. While it may have started as a series of isolated incidents, the Gamergate controversy ushered in an era of coordinated, sustained attacks.
And that spread beyond the world of computer games into the worlds of pop culture, sports, politics, and elsewhere. Ghostbusters star Leslie Jones was the target of a widespread campaign of racist and sexist messages, including the hacking of her personal website. Olympic athlete Gabby Douglas reported widespread abuse on social media, and Jewish journalists were the targets of Holocaust-themed harassment during the presidential campaign.
But there's also been pushback. A Breitbart editor was banned from Twitter for allegedly coordinating the attacks on Leslie Jones. Gabby Douglas co-founded an anti-abuse organization called Hack Harassment, and the Anti-Defamation League has kicked off an effort called Innovate Against Hate to cut down on abuse.
Danielle Citron joins us now. She's a professor at the University of Maryland School of Law and author of Hate Crimes in Cyberspace. Danielle, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back on.
So sports, pop culture, politics, how much has online harassment spread over the last couple of years?
Well, you know, it's a pervasive problem, but I'm not entirely sure it's grown astronomically, but we are paying more attention to it. Having, you know, seeing celebrities experience it, whether it's Leslie Jones or Jennifer Lawrence and the spread of her nude photos, I think we're finally paying attention to the problem. And the presidential election, I think, put into, you know, acute light the attacks on journalists, and the kind of silencing that they experience, many leaving Twitter as a result of the abuse. So not sure it's grown. It's a significant problem in the hundreds of thousands of people who experience it every year.
Are women and minority groups the main targets of the worst forms of online harassment?
Yes. So the majority of victims of cyber harassment are female and also people of color and sexual minorities. And the abuse is often sort of sexually humiliating and sexually threatening. So it's, you know, threats, rape threats. It's lies, but sort of the suggestion someone has a sexually transmitted disease and privacy invasions that often involve the posting of nude photos. And, you know, men experience it too, and it often will follow the same playbook. Men are kind of reduced to being gay and then demeaned on that basis and then, you know, said, well, you're going to face anal rape. So it often is like very much the same playbook, but women and minorities are often the subject, more often the subject.
And you mentioned the silencing of people who might try one option to withdraw from social media, the online world. Is that often the goal, silencing voices in these online harassment campaigns?
You know, so often it seems to be, right, that the point is to make people withdraw, to lose their jobs, to be really terrorized. And it works. So a recent report by Data and Society found that like 20% of victims withdrew from the internet. They just figured it wasn't worth it. And it's, you know, it's working. Trolls, they succeed in their efforts. And that is a real loss to society.
And a lot of times one response to people suffering from this is for people to tell them, yeah, we'll just get off social media. It's no big deal. But in our modern working world, for a lot of people in a lot of lines of work, that's not really a viable option, is it?
Right. I mean, so to say to a journalist, just, you know, shut off Twitter. You know, so often law enforcement will say to people, just, you know, shut down those profiles. What do you need to be on Twitter? What do you need to be on Facebook? Or why do you need to have a blog? It's crucial. There's so many careers where having a social media presence is indispensable to getting a job, keeping a job, and getting the word out there. So it's almost like saying to a journalist, like, you don't have to have a Twitter account. Like, you don't have to work. And we know that most employers use, you know, Google and other search engines to check up on an interviewee. And so often the case, if they don't find anything, that also raises a red flag if someone retreats. And if they find negative information, then they're unlikely to get the job or the interview.
Now, when we're talking about something as bad as threats of violence of some sort, you said we're paying more attention to these problems. Are law enforcement officials starting to take this more seriously?
You know, I think there's some good news, right? when I first started working on these issues in 2007, both state, local, and federal law enforcement, the response was like, "Oh, believe me, we have bigger problems. You just turn off your computer." But I think we're seeing states and localities pay more attention, especially when you have leadership, like we saw the Attorney General of California, who's now U.S. Senator Kamala Harris. When she was in office for 2 years, she spent incredible energy educating law enforcement, creating resources for victims, teaching peace officers about crimes that exist on the books in California that can be brought to bear against harassers and stalkers. So, I think, California isn't the only state increasingly paying attention. We're seeing it. It's a slow process, though. I don't want to overstate matters. There's a lot of education that needs to happen, both on the technology and then also on the law for law enforcement.
Talking to Danielle Citrin, author of Hate Crimes in Cyberspace, looking at coordinated online harassment campaigns against celebrities, everyday people, journalists, and efforts to push back. And let's get into that now, Danielle. It seems like we mentioned a couple of groups that have recently formed to try to turn the tide on online harassment. Are we seeing more pushback efforts like that?
We are. So, I love the new entrance to this space, hack harassment, especially when you have a high-profile person who's behind it, who can garner public support. There are groups like the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative and Without My Consent who've been working with victims but also with lawmakers across the country to criminalize non-consensual pornography, the posting of nude imagery without someone's consent and in violation of their privacy. And there's been incredible success. So Cyber Civil Rights Initiative worked with lawmakers in 34 states and that now have laws on the books that criminalize the posting of nude photos in violation of someone's sexual privacy. So we've been seeing real results, too. What I think we need to see now is, of course, the enforcement of these laws and teaching law enforcement. But that will happen in time, hopefully. So groups have had a big impact, I think, on the way we understand this problem.
This is often seen as a problem between online harassers and their direct victim. In schools, it seems like a lot of anti-bullying efforts focus on the bystanders, what people, third parties can do to intervene and shut down a situation. Is there something like that when it comes to online harassment?
There is some potential, certainly, for bystander support, especially when you're a moderator of a blog or a moderator, let's say, of a subreddit. When you see abuse happening, you can step in, shut it down. If you have control over the content, stop it. But sometimes the problem is when people step in to defend victims, they become victims themselves. So it is a dangerous proposition when you put your neck out to protect someone. There certainly is the risk that the cyber mob identifies you as next. So I've seen both. In my book, I talk about scenarios where, people just trying to stand up for others online and protect them ended up provoking the mob to set upon them. So I think we should consider all ways in which we can combat this problem. And sometimes being a bystander is really effective if you're a moderator of a blog or a group online. And if you can shut it down or create speed bumps to this kind of abuse. But it's not without risk and worth thinking about.
And how about providers of various services, the Twitters and Reddits, Facebooks of the world? What role do they play?
So, I think what's energizing and hopeful is that really powerful platforms like Twitter and Facebook, YouTube and others have been engaged in the last couple of years of fighting back against abuse. Twitter in the last 2 years has now banned threats, harassment, stalking, and hateful conduct and has hired many more reviewers, has clarified their terms of use, and have made real efforts. They recognize that, their platform has been used for really hateful and destructive ends, and they want to do better. So we've seen the CEO come forward and say, we've screwed up, we want to do better. So I think they've played a role, what we might say, they're as good Samaritans to address really destructive uses of their platform without squelching expression overly. It's a fine line for them, right? It's hard to scale, but at least we're seeing some efforts by some of these important main intermediaries.
Piece of news or two lately. The journalist Kurt Eichenwald had been critical in his writing of Donald Trump a lot. He'd been harassed online. He has some form of epilepsy, and I understand somebody had tweeted a flashing image that actually was intended and did, I guess, trigger an epileptic fit. That's really pushing the envelope of harassment, and that's an attack of sorts.
That's right. I would consider it a form of assault or virtual assault. And this wasn't certainly the first time we've seen this. There was the epilepsy support group has a website. And a number of years ago, trolls attacked the website and embedded code that would cause flashing lights for some epileptics like Mr. Eichenwald. It causes attacks. And so that is absolutely assault. And ought to be understood as criminal behavior. So it's distressing, and hackers know what they're doing, right? There are individuals who are bent on really destructive ends. And I think in the case of the journalist, it seems very clearly designed to not only hurt him physically, but also to shove him offline and silence him.
So a bad story to end on there, but do you see, as we wrap up just briefly, are you seeing steps toward positive changes?
Yeah, I wish I had like the happy story that you had in your last segment. But I think there is good that we're seeing here. More and more victims are coming forward. They're going to law enforcement rather than like hiding in the shadows. I think increasingly law enforcement is taking this seriously. Lawmakers, state and federal lawmakers, recognize online abuse and stalking as a real problem. And I think the more and more we talk about it, and as journalists talk about it as a social problem, I think we're going to see improvement.
Danielle, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Danielle Citrin, professor at the University of Maryland School of Law. She's the author of Hate Crimes in Cyberspace. She joined us to bring us up to date with the latest on online harassment.